we have to be very, very careful. What we're talking is not so much democracy, we're talking organised hypocrisy. Hard facts.
The Prime Minister gave a commitment that she would treat Scotland as part of a union of equals. Yet last night, she pressed ahead with a power grab in direct opposition to Scotland's elected parliament. The Prime Minister silenced Scotland's voice. Will the Prime Minister now commit to bringing forward emergency legislation so that the will of the Scottish Parliament can be heard and, more importantly, respected?
Say to the Right Honourable Gentleman that we do expect that the outcome, and it will happen, that the outcome of the whole process of Brexit is going to be a significant increase in Holyrood's decision-making power. It is not the case that this is in any way a power grab.
In light of the persistent and repeated refusal of the Right Honourable Gentleman to resume his seat when so instructed, I order the Right Honourable Gentleman to withdraw immediately from the House for order for the remainder of this day's sitting. Very well. Very well. Very well.
They ripped up the convention that has underpinned devolution for nigh on 20 years. They did so in the most contemptuous way possible, with a 15-minute debate and no opportunity for a single Scottish MP to get to speak. And they hoped that nobody would notice. Well, thanks to SNP MPs doing their job, standing up for Scotland, people have noticed.
The union between Scotland and England, established in 1707, is now incompatible with a world which in 2018 has never been more interdependent, and which has no place for the kind of atavistic and retrograde nationalist tropes unleashed by Brexit. Becoming ever more clear as the political crisis spawned by the decision of the people of England and Wales to exit the EU in 2016, while the people of Scotland and the North of Ireland elected to remain, is that Brexit is not the cause of the unsustainability of the Union. It is merely its most egregious manifestation. In 2014, I was opposed to Scottish independence. In 2018, I support it. Why? Simply because, in light of Brexit, it is no longer possible for me to deny the fact that there can never be unity among ordinary working people in a polity which is rooted in a colonial identity that has and continues to sow a false consciousness among a large segment of its population. And this false consciousness is an impediment to the kind of class consciousness which for me is coterminous with a society underpinned by social and economic justice. Now, I am not attempting to argue here that Scotland is some kind of progressive utopia, but at this juncture, it is significantly more progressive, even within the constraints of devolved government, with regard to its dominant cultural and political values compared to those that hold sway south of the border. Whether we are talking about engagement with the world, belief in the verities of diversity and multiculturalism, or the role and status of migrants. When your politics is reduced to believing that the ills of society are due to the presence of Polish plumbers and Bulgarian bricklayers in your country, your politics is broken. When you are living in a country whose head of state is an unelected, hereditary monarchy, yet you have the temerity to excoriate the EU on grounds of democracy, you are living in cloud cuckoo land. And when you find yourself arguing for the repatriation of powers from Brussels, when those powers are only responsible for 13% of your country's laws, and by far the most progressive of those laws, this is not support for national sovereignty. It is a sign of national insecurity. There is no gainsaying the fact that the EU is in desperate need of reform. The neoliberal economic model it currently operates is broken beyond repair. In its place is required one that prioritises not the interests and profits of global corporations, banks and financial institutions, but those of society at large, placing a premium on stability, cohesion, sustainability and justice. It's the difference between a banker's Europe and a social Europe. A Europe, by the way, that must include Russia and must exclude the United States. Scotland is not and has never been a region within the UK. It is and has always been a partner nation of the UK. Yet if Brexit has exposed anything, it is that in the eyes of an antediluvian UK political class, Scotland should know its place as a former rather than enjoy the respect associated with the latter. Thus, 4 years after the referendum on Scotland's future within the UK in 2014, the issue of Scottish independence is not only back on the table, it is back on it with a vengeance. I'm John White, and this is Hard Facts. Well, I'm delighted to welcome back to the show Paul Monaghan. Paul is a former Scottish National Party MP and currently plies his trade as an academic and researcher. Paul, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much, John.
Now, we heard a glimpse in the sound intro of the Scottish National Party's Ian Blackford, the head of the parliamentary group of Scottish National Party MPs in the House of Commons in London, his sharp exchange with Prime Minister Theresa May at Prime Minister's Question over the issue of Brexit and Scotland's status in regard to Brexit. This ended with Ian Blackford demanding that the voice of Scotland be heard in the course of this debate, and he was ultimately expelled from the House by Speaker John Bercow as a result, prompting a mass walkout of all the Scottish National Party MPs from the Commons. Now, this was an event suffused with significance, in my view, given where we are with regard to Brexit. Detractors of the SNP tried to dismiss it as a mere stunt. It was more than a stunt, wasn't it?
I think it was a hugely significant event at Prime Minister's Questions last Wednesday. I think, you know, your listeners might be interested to consider the perspective that Westminster adopts towards the Scottish Parliament. And that perspective is that the Scottish Parliament is frankly just another council. It's not a parliament of a nation. It's not a parliament that represents the interests of a people. It is just another council that has some responsibilities for delivering public services. Now, in that context, you can see that the outlook from Westminster is completely different to the outlook and the perspective of people living in Scotland. Now, I think what we saw at Prime Minister's Questions last week was a very visible example of that difference in perspectives being played out. We had Ian Blackford on the one hand trying to represent the interests of all of the people of Scotland in terms of protecting our way of life and the values that we adhere to, whilst at the same time, the establishment at Westminster doing its level best to make sure that the views of the representatives of the people of Scotland were not heard and were not considered. So we had Ian Blackford make a perfectly legitimate request for Parliament to sit in private, which is just a vehicle for having a debate. And the Speaker, John Bercow, who you played a little bit in your introduction, misinterpreting and misapplying the standing orders of the House of Commons to exclude Ian Blackford, and quite rightly in that context, all of his colleagues at Westminster chose to support him by walking out, and in the process gave a very visible demonstration of their determination to protect the rights and the interests and the values of all of the people of Scotland. So that's what we saw happened. I think we can infer from that democracy at Westminster is not particularly interested in Scotland. It's not particularly focused on Scotland. It doesn't particularly understand Scotland. And, you know, that's my perspective and my experience, I suppose, as an MP.
It's almost like the view Scotland is merely an irritation, an annoyance, a noisy irritation that needs to continually be put back in its place. Now, surveying the wreckage of Brexit over these last couple of years since the EU referendum in 2016, you could be mistaken for thinking that this Tory government is doing everything it can to affect the breakup of the UK rather than trying to foment its unity, it's denying any possibility of Scotland via the Scottish Government, led by Nicola Sturgeon at Holyrood in Edinburgh, at the Scottish Parliament, from effecting some kind of compromise, which even her opponents and detractors cannot argue that she has been trying her best to do so, based on the breakdown of the vote, which I'll remind the listeners, saw 62% of voters in Scotland voting to remain in the EU. Now, those democratic rights are being outrageously violated. What's your take on this Tory party policy? Is it just because of this mindset, this little Englander mindset, which dominates their thinking, or is there something more political at work?
I think it is a mindset. It is peculiar to Westminster. I mean, the UK government at the moment is not interested in compromise. It's inward facing. It's unwilling to enter dialogue, not just with the people of Scotland, but with other nations and other structures and bodies that, you know, were once considered valued partners. So, you know, the way that the UK government is treating the EU, I think, is just frankly disgraceful. The fact that the UK government won't listen to the people of Scotland doesn't seem to be particularly peculiar in that context, where, frankly, it's not listening to anybody else either. So I think, you know, the UK government, the ministers, the cabinet, do, I think, view the people of Scotland and the Scottish Parliament. It's not the Scottish government that's represent his views on this particular occasion. It's the Scottish Parliament and the people of Scotland who want to remain within the EU. You know, to consider all of that just a minor irritation, I think, betrays the real attitude and the real outlook towards Scotland that we see at Westminster.
Now, the fact that the SNP enjoyed a spike in membership of, I think it was over 5,000 in the wake of this walkout that we've just been discussing, that tells its own story. I think there's a feeling in Scotland that the Scottish government, the SNP, needs now to take this issue by the scruff of the neck and put a second referendum on independence firmly on the table. There is a feeling, I think you may agree, feel free to disagree if you do so, that the SNP has been kind of parking the issue, maybe for good reason. Perhaps you could enumerate those reasons. But do you see that this is now a changed situation and that independence is now on the table in the form of a second referendum on an issue that many had thought had been settled for a generation back in 2014?
Well, I don't think the issue of a second referendum has ever really been off the table, to be honest with you. I mean, almost immediately after the vote in 2014, we had David Cameron go on TV and basically betray all of the promises that had been made during the campaign and the run-up to the vote. So I think, you know, as soon as David Cameron opened his mouth on the 20th of September, I think it was, 2014, the referendum, a second referendum, was back on the table. You know, we arrive at the point we're at today where, you know, change is very significant in many people's lives. Lots of people are worried about their jobs. They're worried about the fragmentation and the erosion of the economic and social progress that has been developed within the Scottish Parliament and within Scottish politics, perhaps more generally, since 1997. And they see all of that being lost. You know, that fundamentally is the issue here. It is affecting people's quality of life and their outlook. It's affecting their social well-being, their family networks, and, you know, frankly, their wealth. So, you know, these are the things that people are taking to heart. And, you know, today, I think they're looking for increasingly affirmative action. They're not prepared to acquiesce any longer. And, you know, I think the fact that I think it's over 10,000 people have joined the SNP in just the last week, you know, is a very real and tangible example of that that concern and that worry that's affecting lots of people.
You're listening to Paul Monaghan. This is Hard Facts. We'll be right back.
We have to be very, very careful. What we're talking is not so much democracy, we're talking organised hypocrisy. Hard Facts.
Welcome back to the second half of Hard Facts. I'm sitting down with Paul Monaghan, former Scottish National Party MP, academic and researcher, and we are discussing the unsustainability, I think is the right word, of a union that was established in the interests of a rising mercantilist class in Scotland and England in 1707, which is now, in my view, completely incompatible with a modern world. Now, Paul, the issue of immigration is probably the most controversial throughout the West. We see the disgusting and disgraceful and contemptible policy of the US government separating families at the Mexican border, demonising them all as criminals, as subhumans. Certainly in the context of that horrible and horrific policy, immigration in Europe is a massive issue. We've just seen an anti-migrant, explicitly anti-migrant government come to power in Italy. Anti-migrant parties are on the march throughout Europe, and there's a real strain of anti-immigration which underpins Brexit. In fact, I would say it was a dominant current within the bunch of political currents that drove Brexit. Yet Scotland is unique in the sense that the nationalism which dominates Scottish politics is an inclusive nationalism. It's welcoming to migrants. It treats migrants with the hand of friendship rather than the fist of fury. Give us your explanation of the difference between Scotland and other parts of Europe when it comes to the particular brand of nationalism which underpins Scottish nationalism.
I think you're right, John. Nationalism in Scotland is inclusive, it is welcoming, and it is not judgmental, which stands in stark contrast to some of the nationalistic trends that we see in other countries around Europe and indeed around the world. And I agree with you in regards to the policies currently being implemented in the United States in terms of separating children from their parents. I think, you know, we should all be very concerned about that. That is not a sustainable position, as you've suggested. But, you know, I think many people are viewing migration around the world as, quite frankly, being the repercussions of foreign wars that have taken place in the past, where economies have been destroyed, leaving whole peoples with no other option than to pack up their bags and try to move to protect their families. You know, fundamentally, I think that's the issue at large here that the world faces today. Economies have been destroyed. What is the developed world doing to help those nations to rebuild their economy and to protect their peoples? And frankly, the answer is nothing at all.
They're not taking responsibility for the chaos that they are causing with their own foreign policy.
They're not. No, absolutely they're not. In fact, I think in many parts of the world, the situation is becoming worse because the West is being increasingly, frankly, greedy. It's stripping resources from developing nations or indeed nations that were developed and have been completely destroyed. You know, these are the issues that are going to stay within our society until something's done about it. And, you know, frankly, having a UK government looking in on itself, trying to isolate itself from the world, is not really the answer. It's got to be participative. It's got to get out there and it's got to be a part of the world if we're going to solve some of these really fundamental problems. You know, you mentioned Italy there and, you know, the fact that they have a new government now who's taken a different approach toward migrants. But we need to remember that Italy, for large part, has dealt with this whole migration issue in Europe on its own without any support from other European nations. There are now over 3 million migrants living in Italy. And, you know, that's not sustainable for the Italian people. You know, that's getting on for 6% of their entire population. If we look into the Middle East, we've got Jordan in a very similar position, absolutely flooded by refugees from Syria, from Lebanon, from Palestine. And, you know, the West isn't helping them either. So, you know, we need to reimagine our relationships with the rest of the world. I think the people of Scotland are very good at doing that. They're very good at taking responsibility for their actions that, you know, occurred in the past. And we're very good at looking to the future and thinking about better ways to do things. I think, you know, as an independent nation, that's exactly what we could and should be doing, rather than ploughing money and huge sums of money into more weapons, more destruction, and making the situation, frankly, a lot worse.
Yeah, we have to reconfigure not only our national politics, but our international politics. And we have to understand that traditionally the condition for the development of the Northern Hemisphere has been the underdevelopment of the Southern Hemisphere, and that can no longer obtain because of the chaos and the crises that are breaking out, catalysed by these foreign wars, where extreme poverty is driving millions of people to seek sanctuary. They're not coming here for a holiday. People who come to the West in such a parlous condition do so in a state of extremis. They are terrified, they are traumatised, and yet to treat them with such hostility is a double injustice, it seems to me. And so, yeah, across Europe, this is what I mean, Paul, that the EU needs to reform. You're right, Italy has been forced to bear the brunt of this migrant and refugee crisis purely on grounds of its geography. But if the EU is to stand for anything, it cannot just preach unity when things are going well and then retreat into its own national particularisms when things are not going well. And here we have to identify the role of Angela Merkel in Germany, because it's her policy of austerity or bust within the context of the Eurozone that I think is making this crisis worse. Would you agree?
I absolutely agree that the EU is an institution and a structure that we should place a significant value on. You know, we should never, ever allow ourselves to forget that the EU is the product of the Second World War, and it has maintained peace amongst countries that not that long ago were fighting one another and killing each other's people. So, you know, we don't want to go back to that. We do have the EU that has brought a great deal of opportunity to all of the countries of the EU. It's advanced social progress, it's advanced technology, it's improved the quality of life in immeasurable ways. That's something that we should be trying to build on just now, not trying to destroy it or erode it or fight against it, which sadly, I think, is what we see across Europe in many of the countries. Self-interest, I think, is overtaking social responsibility in a lot of different ways. And, you know, that's something that I think sits at odds, particularly with the people of Scotland. But I know from my own travels, and I'm sure you do as well, it's at odds with many ordinary people across the entire EU. And, you know, again, I come back to the point, you know, we really should be trying to reimagine our relationships with the world, not simply withdraw from them. We should be trying to reimagine how we can support countries in the Middle East and in Africa to rebuild their economies and start to exploit their resources in sustainable ways so that people don't want to leave those nations. And you're right, those people are on the move because they are an extremist. They are literally starving to death. They've been bombed out of their homes. Their schools have been destroyed. They've got no medical care. They've got no way to access opportunities to build a future. And that is hugely regrettable. And we all need to take responsibility for that.
Paul, I'm sure you agree with me. I don't have any confidence that the Tory ideas that dominate our politics in the UK are capable of fomenting the kind of world, the kind of justice that you have just eloquently described. Whether it's its institutions, the way it treats children in this country, 4 million children in the UK living in poverty, food bank use on the rise, Dickensian levels of poverty. I mean, it's an utter disgrace that this Tory government is still able to hang on to power, given the grievous consequences of its austerity programme going back to 2010. This is why I am minded to believe that the UK is unsustainable. There's nothing it can really do to reform its way out of this mess. I don't even think Jeremy Corbyn, who I have a lot of respect for, is capable of turning this ship around. Why? Because the rot runs so deep and the contradictions thrown up by Brexit, I don't think they can be surmounted. In 2014, even though I was opposed to Scottish independence, I did recognise that a national consciousness was raised in the context of that campaign that is not going to go to sleep anytime soon, if ever. And I think this is what is driving the call for a second referendum. How confident would you be, Paul, that Scotland would win its independence the second time round? And what needs to change in terms of the arguments being made to bring people who were opposed or who are sceptical now into the fold in Scotland?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of complicated factors at play in that whole debate, really. But I know I agree with you that I think politics in the UK is broken now. I don't think it's repairable. you know, we're about to witness, you know, one of the greatest acts of self-harm ever inflicted on a nation, which is leaving the EU, and the economic carnage and the social inequality and disadvantage that will accompany that. So we're about to enter a very regressive society. And I think increasingly people are aware of that. They understand how that's going to affect themselves and their families, and of obviously the impacts that will have on wider outlooks in terms of foreign policy and so on and so forth. So, you know, if there's going to be a second referendum, I think we need to be able to communicate that all of that is not a social fact. It's an aspiration of a group of people who at this point in time happen to compose the government of the UK. It doesn't need to be the outcome. The outcome can change. All we need to do is make sure that our voices are heard, that we stand up for what is right and proper, that we make our voice heard, and that we do it in a way that is persuasive to those who perhaps, you know, aren't on social media, tend perhaps not to watch the news on TV or read the newspapers, etc., and may be oblivious to some of the wider impacts that are taking place. But I think, you know, there is an awakening happening. It's not a new development. It's been on the go for quite a long time now, but it is growing. It is gathering pace. It is attracting people to it. I think we've seen that recently in the huge all under one banners marches that have taken place throughout Scotland, and there'll be more of them soon. And it's not aligned with a political party. This is a real social movement. It's people from all walks of life, all political ideologies, saying, you know, quite frankly, enough is enough. Scotland is a nation. We've got distinctive values. We've got a distinctive culture. We want to make sure that that is protected and that it's taken to the world in the future. We want to be part of the world. We want to be a valued partner. The only way that we're going to be able to do that is as an independent nation.
An independent Scotland is part of an interdependent social Europe. Well, this is my idea of a future worth fighting for. You've been listening to Paul Monaghan. I'm John White. Until next time, remember, the only facts worth taking seriously are hard facts.